Yo, mic check, check 1, 2. Public access, broadcasting live on the web, Fat Lab. Yo. All right, here we go. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Fat Public Access. I'm your host, Bennett Williamson, back once again in the echoey space of iBeam, doing our awesome alternative broadcasting stream, which is going to be going on all week. Let's see what's going on later tonight. From 9 to 10 p.m., there's going to be an awesome performance from Eric Ricky Laska, who's a member of Double Happiness, the legendary mid-2000s internet art collective. Full disclosure, so am I. But he's going to be giving a performance called the Long Cable, which consists of him conducting an interview over a 500-foot XLR cable and then doing a noise set over that, too. So it's going to be tight. So if you're in New York, you can come on down to iBeam for that. And check, if you go to our website, fffff.at, you're probably already there. But anyways, you can see the old videos that we've been doing. We had some nice talks yesterday and some performances. So, but a big part of why I wanted to do this in the first place was that like Fat Lab never gets to hang out together. We just send a million emails to each other all day, every day, half of which I just like do not read. I'm like, oh my God, I cannot read this. I can't deal with this right now. But so it's rare that we get to meet up, and I just wanted to use this as a forum to talk shop about Fat Lab. Sup, Aram? And so I'd like to bring on one of the big Mac Daddies, old OGs of Fat Lab, Evan Roth. Please come to the stage and join me. All right, here. You got your own. Check it.
Good to be here with you. Sound good, man.
Hey, Mike. You wanna take a look at the? You wanna give Evan some levels? Cause I don't wanna
check,
overdo
check.
Him.
Greetings, all.
Hey. Oh, sorry. We're not really.
You can share your mic. No. Come on, we got time.
We're checking the mic. Ooh, that sounds good.
Just look at the green dots, smart guy.
This one's Evan. Check. Look at the green dots.
I'm just trying to show some respect to the founder of Fat Lab here. that's fine. All right, you guys, whatever.
Check. I'm too low.
One or two, man.
This one is Evan. Check. I can talk louder. That's fine.
This is why I do it myself. All right, whatever. Thanks, guys. Fat Lab behind the scenes. I know you guys are doing it right. Shout out to Becky. Shout out to Michael and Addy. That's me. Yo, I don't need to be this loud. This is hacking right now. Are we hacking? We should have done like a comedy, like a tech comedy segment. It's not too late. Anyways, Evan, you're a ginger. And so this is an intervention. This is an intervention. No, I'm kidding. Evan, I have some carrots. We're going to... No, so yeah, Evan, it's great to see you.
Good to see you as well, man.
It's been a while. I guess last time I saw you was for your solo speed show, I think, in Chinatown.
That's right.
In New York, at least 2 years ago or so, something
curated
like that.
Curated by Aram Barthol.
Yeah, I know. Fat Lab member. Maybe we can have him jump up in a chair at some point. But yeah, let's take the time machine back, my man. When did this Fat Lab thing get started?
So it must be 5.5 years from now, right?
Oh, yeah, right, because this is the 5-year anniversary. So that's 2007 and a half. Oh, yeah, plus, yeah.
No, so we're here at iBeam, which is fitting, right?
Because Prodigal Son.
Fat Lab really sprang from Graffiti Research Lab, which sprang from the iBeam Open Lab, which was started by Jonah Peretti and Mike Fruman, who are kind of the original OG at least iBeamers, but probably FatLabbers also, right?
That's like, true. And FatLab members today.
True. And a lot of, I think, what FAT is just trying to preserve what many of us felt when we went through that Open Lab fellowship program. And Jonah at the time was, you know, he was experimenting with contagious media. This is pre-BuzzFeed, but post-Huffington Post, you know? So he had already gotten his feet wet in terms of making the number one most popular blog on the internet. And so in that original group, you were there right from the start too, right?
I was there in the Graffiti Research Lab days, I think circa like 2006 or whatever. I was a student at NYU. I did a tour of iBeam through a class, like a new media class. And then you guys offered an internship, and so did Corey Archangel, who was sort of like a original research and development member. And I applied for both, and you guys never got back to me. But
I think you picked smartly.
Yeah, I think it worked out great because I ended up interning for Corey, but then hanging out with you guys and just getting to throw down on the Graffiti Research Lab projects. And I remember specifically like the day that there was this show where Worcester Collective, which we were very sort of like near in that was very hot at the time, and they were going to do that show.
Right.
And so you guys,
the 11 had, Spring Speech show, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Legendary. And oh, ooh, thank you, Becky. Great job. Thank you, audience online, for checking in. This is great. You can't beat the FatLab tech crew. So the Spring Street show was going on, and I remember coming in and like I think you and James had like been up all night concocting this safety advisory tower piece, and you guys were like bleary-eyed, looking around like, but how are we gonna put it up? And then you were like, yo, Bennett, can you help us? And I was like, yeah, I think so. I think I ditched like my internship with Corey basically to go be in a street art show with you guys. And so from there, I was like, you know, down sort of hype man, cameraman, assistant, not doing any of the coding, but doing a lot of the bicycling, filming, hyping, and whatnot. So
no, that was the start of some good times, right?
Yo, really good times, really formative. And it's been surprisingly like a kernel of my life that has branched out into a lot of things like work, personal life, art world, and so yeah,
into this.
Yeah, exactly. So what you guys were in residence at the time, and then Graffiti Research Lab. We did some different projects around the world, and
yeah, I think the history, if that's what we're talking about, is James Powderly and myself had iBeam fellowships for a year that got extended to 2 years, and with that time, the majority of the work James and I were doing collaboratively was Graffiti Research Lab projects with branched out to collaborations with yourself, Theo Watson,
Steve Lambert,
people that are around here. Yeah, and I think the way that kind of transitioned into FatLab was that James and I and all these other people we were working with, especially I think it was sitting next to Jonah a lot too. Like I think Jonah's kind of idea about how ideas can sort of spread, you know, contagiously on the web. Those were filtering around the lab a lot. Like that wasn't a mandate, but that was an influence that was felt because it was exciting because this was, yeah, it was long enough ago that I think Jonah came up with the term contagious media. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know, man.
I wasn't here when
he was here.
Early in this kind of viral media thing.
I'll give him credit. Sure.
Let's give him credit.
Yeah.
And so I think we were kind of, Jonah's work experimented with that, with like the Nike sweatshop thing and Black People Love Us and these sort of projects that didn't fit cleanly within an art practice, but were very seen online. And I think a lot of the people, myself included, that were in the Open Lab had, and Jonah too, I mean, he had sort of political interests. And so what happened with GRL outside of graffiti and outside of open source was also this idea of kind of taking these potentially unpopular ideas, you know, and trying to sort of spread those through media that's more easily digestible.
Ideas about open source, ideas about DIY,
ideas about free speech.
Free speech,
culture.
Yeah, for sure. Public space, taking over public space.
I think all that scene was early then. I mean, like the first project that GRL did was the LED Throwies one.
Right.
And we published it on Instructables, which a lot of people didn't know about. Like this is one of the first like blowout or breakout Instructable pieces too. So we were kind of growing up like with that whole community of people. And anyway, after traveling around, as you know, because you were on some of these trips too, like we were doing projects that we, you know, we're having that reach, right? That we're reaching people in a way that wasn't just hitting the tech scene, wasn't just hitting the art scene, but it was like young people. It was people that could care less about the politics, just wanted to come out and like draw penises with a laser on a building. It's a great audience.
Definitely.
And at some point, I think, I forget exactly where these conversations happened, but I remember James and I were talking about like how can we take some of these things that we learned through the media. I think the big thing of GRL in the end was really a social hack, right? Like it was really more about, it wasn't about technically hacking lasers and motion tracking and, you know, LED throwies and all this stuff. It was really about how those technologies then hack the media, right? How you could write something with a marker on a poster and go to protest and probably aren't going to make the front page of New York Times. But if you write that same thing with a laser on a building, or you write that same thing with LEDs and go to Beijing, like you're going to, the media is going to be more likely to report on that because they like tech, they like things that light up.
It's interesting to think in a way that some of the work that was coming out of here was sort of shaping. You forget, it's easy in hindsight to think like that the way that media was going to get consumed on the web was like through this form, like, oh, hey, what's catchy in a short video and sound and like funny and shareable. But in a way, some of the projects that were happening here, and another one that comes to mind is like Know Your Meme and like the FAMO class and stuff. It's interesting to think that those kind of research projects and the resultant sort of sites and types of publishing that came out of that actually influenced the way that things were consumed and like helped make a blog like BuzzFeed become the norm for the way that media is consumed. So,
'cause it really at the time was not the norm. And I think that's why a lot of us that were in this lab that's right over here were, I don't know, drunk with power is the wrong term, but you get this. I mean, the thing I love about the internet is that it's this, it's empowering as all hell, right? And what we were realizing is, you know, like the Fat Lab model release early often with rap music, it's like partly a joke, but we were actually doing that. I mean, we were kind of making these pieces and putting like a hip hop track on it and really tracking it go around the web. And I mean, part of what we would talk about in this FAMO class was getting students used to feeling not guilty about like checking how their work travels. Because when you figure out how it travels throughout these networks, it teaches you about those networks. It teaches you how to talk to those networks. And so we got comfortable with not feeling guilty about checking our Google Analytics account, with not feeling guilty about checking to see if we've made these blogs. Because when you're doing activist-leaning work, the idea of getting eyeballs, you shouldn't feel bad about. Like, that's kind of the definition of an awareness campaign.
Right.
And I think a lot of people that are in the arts have a sort of aversion to even talking about that publicly, that they care that people see their work. And I think most people I know that make things, part of them makes them to be experienced, you know, whether it's an activist piece or not. I don't think that all artwork has to exist that way, right? I don't think that getting on the front page of Boing Boing means it's the arts any better. But no. I think within an art practice that's engaged with social activism, I think it is valid to talk about these things. And that's kind of what Graffiti Research Lab was doing. And to come back to FAT, that was why. In some of those conversations James and I were having, we were saying, how can we take all that stuff that we kind of learned through going through this experiment with Graffiti Research Lab and remove this requirement that it be about graffiti?
Yeah, right.
And just open it up.
Right, open up the content to sort of anything.
And open it up to more people, too.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about FAT is it's so international. I think there's like, you know, it started here in certain ways, but yeah, it's sort of spread worldwide. I mean, you fled the country, James fled the country. but I remember like the first, it was also like, you know, yeah, GRL was sort of, it was like, okay, we've really milked this graffiti content as much as we love it. Perhaps we could appeal to an even wider audience or hit some different groups if we have a different kind of content. And
also just selfishly, I think, I mean, speaking for myself and probably James as well, like, I just wanted to work with more people. I didn't want, like, I was, you know, meeting people that were hanging around here. I was meeting people traveling to different art events, meeting people outside the graffiti scene and wanting to work with them in a way that felt like the graffiti was kind of forcing it, you know?
Right, yeah.
Because I think a lot of the people in Fat Lab came in through personal connections from one person or
the other. Yeah, I mean, as any other sort of collective probably would. But, I don't know. I remember, like, a meeting. We had a meeting at my, like, apartment that I lived in.
I remember
like,
one of the only meetings Fat Labs ever had, right?
Yeah, but that was, like, I don't know, it had this feeling of like, well, what is this going to be? Like, are we going to start a space? Are we going to have our own lab? Are we going to incorporate or become like a nonprofit? You know, I think some of it was like trying to think about the resources that we were giving up from moving away from iBeam. James and I and Todd had a little studio space with the laser cutter in it for a while. That was sort of, at times, there was one point where it was like, oh, this is the Fat Lab, but it was just like a studio in Bushwick that eventually James fled the country. I couldn't really pay rent because I was a broke ass, like post-collegiate, not knowing what was going on. So I think Todd, shout out to Todd, ImageNode, is probably still holding it down over there. So the notion of like a terra firma for Fat Lab never really sort of took hold. And
I think to its own benefit, though.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so much of the focus was like about speed, and like, you know, the whole idea of like the speed project. It was like just make it happen on your own, and get enough people that sort of inevitably it seems like there's something happening on the blog. And I mean, one thing that's, you know, obviously we're hard to organize, and like I said, occasions like this where we all get together rarely happen. But of course, that's like the strength of like a network too, right? It's like there's no sort of single weak link that's going to topple Fat Lab. It's interesting to see, like, I don't post a lot, you know, on the site. I feel like I don't actually make projects that sort of like fit with the Fat Lab like aesthetic and what some of the ideals are, you know, like I have my sort of artistic practice in other areas, but again, the ideas and the conversations that happen on the list like feed sort of my angles and my, you know, social practice and just like my interests.
And that email list is really fat. Right?
Yeah, it's fat.
I
it's
mean,
like
a lot of
even
don't know that, but it's the blog is this one thing that thing work shows up on from time to time, but this kind of internal email list that we're all on. That's really what it is, right? And that's, you know, depending
definitely,
on
yeah.
what's happening, it's a daily thing, right?
Yeah, and it's again, there's like, it's you can dip in, dip out as like as needed. You know, I think I was saying at the beginning, it's like some days I can't handle all the emails.
Yeah, of course. I think a lot of people might have sort of filters in their email that sends all that fat stuff to a certain place and then deals with it at the right time.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're 5 years in. What was it? What's the, like, you guys met at Transmediale. Was that the first time that Fat sort of got together? Like, the last Transmediale? What was that, 3 years ago?
I think it was, like, your apartment, Transmediale, here. And that's about the extent of the AFK Fat work.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's, I don't know. What else should we talk? What's, like, what else can we reveal about the behind
the inner workings of the group, or
yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm realizing it's like so dispersed that there's no way to like, well, we have a secret handshake, and then like, you know, there's no like committees or anything. I think maybe, I don't know. We could see if anyone else wants to get in on this conversation. Hey, Aram, you doing anything?
We can talk to Aram because Aram is someone who is a later addition to the group than many who are here. He was a reluctant addition to the group.
Really?
Received the invitation and played it a little bit cool for a little while. So what were you thinking in those few weeks between the time when you got the invitation and when you finally decided to say yes?
I don't remember what I was thinking, but I mean, of course, we met in 2006, so way earlier than
yes.
than Fat was founded. So I think one of the things was always like, oh yeah, Toby asked me in the beginning also, and yeah, it's cool. Like, I like to look at what you do, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to be part of the fuck you thing. This was like one of the hesitations, I guess. But yeah. And then in the beginning of 2009, when Pirate Bay trial was on, in fact, Geraldine was like, yeah, we're doing something, and you should be on the list now. And then it's like, yeah, cool. And being member of really becoming part of Fat was like was a super cool experience. It changed a lot my way of working and.
And you were a big influence on everyone in the group as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, but also was like really big influence on me too. And I mean, I've been following your stuff and GL and all this over the years, and I think there's like a whole this whole language or attitude. This is like, something very strong.
I wanted to ask you, Aram, because, you know, for for me, it was pretty straightforward. Like, oh, iBeam is the center of this, like, these kinds of ideas. This is where this kind of art and technology work. I just have to be associated with that. But obviously, you're based in Berlin. You know, is there like a, I don't know, not a similar place, but what was your source, like? What got you on the, was there like a space or a group of people, or just like, where did this sort of sentiment, maybe how did technology get into your work? Like, because, you know, you're in a whole other country. I guess for me, it's like, oh yeah, everyone knows about iBeam, but I realized that other people just came to this kind of work through different channels.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's, of course, my own practice and my own influence, like, on one hand, going to art school, studying architecture, being on the internet, blah, 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 making these things. And there were lots of things in common, just the way of making things, putting out the manuals, like making a piece, I don't know, like random screen with tea candle lights. And for me, it was sort of being on the internet and see all these instructable stuff was sort of, yeah, very natural to put this out, and it's part of the art piece. And with you guys seeing GIL, like making, I don't know, LED throwies and laser tag in this very radical way of making it open source, and it's all over the internet, and in the end, like, it's really hard to track. Everybody used it, and I had always, yeah, a lot of respect for this, yeah, because it's not, as an artist, you're in between, yeah, it should be open, everybody should use it, but you also have your artist ego, like, which is with the piece, and it's like this in between, and I, yeah, this was like a good point. And in fact, I don't know, like, I'm in Germany, I was in Germany, but my work was discovered sort of, my first show was on Ars Electronica in 2006, and they discovered me through Make magazine.
Oh.
So yeah, there you go, right? So it's like, the kind of work, yeah, probably you posted me, Becky, right?
Would you say like you were into things where you would show the instructions for like how the artwork is made, and you were doing that with your own work, you're saying,
yeah,
sort
yeah,
of before.
Yeah.
So was that coming from like a political choice or like a conceptual art choice? Like how did you start to make that sort of choice with your work?
That's really hard to just, like, to explain. It's just like these, it's not like, I'm not like sitting down with a theory and, oh, let's make an art piece of that. So it's more the way, it's probably influenced from my childhood and the 70s and this whole idea of like sharing and then plus the internet, plus Chaos Computer Club in Germany, the hacker culture. Like I've been there in this congress like since, or yeah, taking part since 97. So,
oh, wow.
there's all these things, or this way of thinking has been around for a while already. So
yeah, yeah. I mean,
when we met, I mean, there were like all these, I remember seeing you and James talk at Ars Electronica. I was like, yeah, I need to show these guys my work and da da da. And like half a year later, I was here at iBeam for the show at Open City show in 2007. So there were lots of like overlapping interests, and
yeah, that was the last time we were both showing together here was at the
yeah
Open City show, which is
it's cool for me. I mean, I guess I think I'm a little younger than both you guys, but and even I was talking to Kevin Driscoll about like FidoNet and like the BBS system, and you know, I think it's really interesting. And something that we don't focus on FAT, but I think maybe we could more in a way, is think, I guess basically the way Kevin was putting it is like looking to the history of people using the web is a great way to sort of frame the arguments about like the rules and changes and sort of, I mean, laws and also both social activities that happen on the web today. And I mean, it seems like perhaps, I guess I wanted to ask both you guys about your, I mean, you said you've been involved with Chaos Computer Club for a long time, but like your early introductions to the web and maybe how that just like, I don't know, like memory lane, like, like where did, yeah, tell me.
Where it started, yeah, I mean, for me it started, I started studying architecture in 95, so I moved from Bremen to Berlin, and I always had friends in Bremen also who, yeah, were like computer geeks, and I was a lot about games, and I'm not a programmer myself, but I always had people around me like knew how to handle the computer. And I came here, and I remember, or I came to Berlin, and I remember that I went over to the technical campus, to the Unix pool, like to write email in Pine or whatever, like Unix program, to one friend in Hamburg. I knew, like, the only guy I knew who had an email address. So
sweet.
And at the same time, we still learned to draw architectural plans with ink, right? So
oh, wow.
It's like this, and of course this is then, yeah, seems very boring, and you read like 2,000-year-old architecture books, Vitruv or whatever, and at the same time there's computer games, and you can design a building and play a shooter in that. It's way more interesting than like drawing by hand. Well, so this was, I was like a mix, and I remember also like at that time friends were asking, or yeah, internet was new, and so what are you needed for? Like, what is it about, right?
Yeah, right.
And it's today, sometimes, yeah, it's probably today the same people asking, like, why are you not on Facebook?
What about you, Evan?
Beginning with the internet?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because architecture is a connection between both of us, but more so than architecture, I had a really negative reaction to cubicle life.
Ah.
Like, I graduated from architecture school, went and, like, got a credit card and bought nice clothes and went to work in an office. It was, like, an interior architecture firm in Washington, D.C., and it was kind of hip, so they had really good computers and a fast internet connection. And this is, like, right when Napster was in its peak, so I was, like, downloading music constantly in the office space and, like, on the internet and just, like, loving it, you know? And so I was, like, I mean, this was an influence on my work in general, too, as just even as an audience.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
was that person, you know?
Wasn't there, so if you're five, isn't there a nine? Isn't there nine and
yeah,
five?
Yeah, so the original website was, like, me and an office worker would meet at lunch. He's a friend of mine back from school. And we would, at lunch, like, pour over Flash manuals, like, back when, like, you know, pre-Adobe, you know, pre-Flash, pre-Action Script. And we were like, we got to do this Flash thing. Because we saw, it was Yugo P. There's like a website called Yugo P. Yugo Nakamura. He's like a Japanese designer. He made the first website I can remember ever seeing where like when you move the mouse, something happens. It was like the first time I'd seen anything online have interactivity beyond like a rollover. And it just shredded me. Like I remember being in the office, like someone called me over to see it. And I was just sitting there on his website and the whole navigation was ridiculous. You know, it was like you zoom in when you go up and you go left and everything shifts over. It was part of that early 2000 Flash internet, which I love. I love that internet, man. It was crazy. It was crazy. And so from there, I wasted so much company time, like, and I convinced them to let me remake their website, and I saved it, and it's ridiculous. It's like, it's exactly what was wrong with that whole generation of, like, early Flash, where, like, there was no navigation, no usability. It was just, like, you'd move and fireworks would go off, you know? And I made the most ridiculous website ever for them, and that's where I learned how to program. And the open source influence came from there too, because I was learning how to program from like looking at Joshua Davis's files. Like I didn't know it was even a political thing then. Like I didn't come through like cool chaos computer hacking systems, or like I wasn't aware of all that. All I knew is like I needed to know how to make this ball bounce, and Joshua Davis was releasing these FLA files, and that's kind of how I learned to program.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, there's just. Yeah, there's a variety of ways in. I just like to hear people's stories when it comes to this stuff. I mean, yeah, I was a little later, so it was like mid-90s, just like games. Like, I forget what it was, like sort of right before the World Wide Web where you could like log on to a service, maybe through your internet provider, and it was like, I just remember it was like a carnival theme and you could like click through to different areas and like there were different kinds of games there. So it was like you could play pool against someone online and there was like already chat back and forth. So I guess I was young enough that there was like the social element of it too. But I remember it being, you know, disorganized and mysterious. And then, getting into Napster, that was a big influence. But I was
Napster
a little...
was huge for me. I had one moment on Napster where I was downloading an album. And you know how you can see like who is seeding it, and you could direct message them basically.
I don't even remember that.
So I was at work downloading an album, and the person stopped the download, and they IM'd me, and they said, "You can download this folder, but first you have to download this other movie off my hard drive and watch it." And he was like an animal rights activist, and it was basically like, a video file from that they'd shot from within inside like a slaughterhouse or something, right? And that blew my mind too, because I was like, "Here's someone who's using entertainment and media in a super interesting way, right? They're seeding content." And when people download it, he makes you download this other file. And once you download that, he'll let you keep getting your, you know,
that's
whatever Radiohead album you're trying to download.
That's wild.
And that stuck with me because I think that's a lot of what the work I do still is. It's like, yeah, okay, you can download Radiohead, but you've got to watch this other thing too, you know.
You can like Michael Jackson, but you have to wait till he dies and let the copyright expire, and then you can hear it playing off this billboard. Hey, Aram, is there any traction on your project in the desert where you're going to remake that Counter-Strike level?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still I'm talking to different people now. Like, first the first attempt is to build sections or like little excerpts of it. And this, there's nothing really to announce now. I don't want to like go into details, but that's still on my list, very up now and working on it.
Sweet. That was just one that I thought was in the background. How are we doing here? Addy, are you going to start soon? Oh, yeah, we could. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, come on.
Cool. Yeah.
Do you want to go? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure.
Thanks,
Aram. Get up here, Addy.
This is
so exciting. So, the Alps rule, Colorado drools for shredding the slopes.
Sweet. I mean, Colorado's not bad. It's just a little flat.
Sorry, we were just talking about the onesie market and snow sports. How did you get wrapped up in this mess? I guess we only just met, like, yesterday
true
or the
story,
day before.
True story.
True enough. Were you here at IBM? Were you a resident?
I was a fellow.
Fellow, excuse me.
Thank you. 2007, 2008, represent with Jerry and who else was here? Steve, Zach Lieberman. So I kind of got tangled up in IBM. Like, I applied for a fellowship just totally out of... I didn't actually even know what IBM was. I just heard about it. So.
How'd you... Did someone tell you about it, or...?
I was at ITP, so a bunch of people were saying IBM, 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 and I looked into it, and they were having a fellowship call, so I just, like, applied, had no idea where it was, got a call, interview, rest is history.
Sweet, skip the about page and just, like, press
exactly.
Send with the CV.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you already, I mean, what kind of work were you making at the time?
I was doing a lot with, actually, like, oddly similar to kind of the laser tag projects, but I was really obsessed with imagery, so I was going around New York, like, collecting pictures of advertising and words, and then I got into the Flickr API, and I started doing, like, a laser tag without even knowing what laser tag was, where you would, like, create haikus using AdWords.
Cool.
And I started projecting that around, and then James Powderly actually saw it, like, introduced himself at one of the shows, and kind of, like, we kept in touch.
And then at some point, you got the official invite.
Yeah, Golan Levin sent me one out of the blue. That
whoa.
Was pretty rock star.
Nice.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Golan. Just met him for the first time, too.
I
so
love
you,
Golan. He's like Yoda.
So you've been knowing him?
Yeah, yeah. So I had a fellowship at Carnegie Mellon, which is where he is. There's like a studio for creative inquiry, and he's the director. And I was there last year for a few months doing some work with the DFAB and the architecture department and the robotics. I developed like an open source laser cutter.
Oh,
so
cool.
We went there and we built a 150-watt system, which is like the strongest cutter they have on the campus. And Golan became my Yoda, so now he's like my go-to whenever I'm freaking out about something. I just like I ping him on GChat and we have like a little hangout session.
good man.
Yeah, yeah, I love him. So,
were you always interested in technology? I guess I was asking these guys kind of about their like youths and like early internet technology. How did you find yourself to be an artist working with projectors on the street?
So my mom was actually a broker, like she traded in finance, and I would go to her office when I was a kid. She had like a Mac SE, and I started playing with Mac Paint and then KidPix, and was like completely obsessed, like just obsessed with it. I didn't realize that there are other people into it. You
did
know,
you know
just,
how
like,
to freeze the explosion?
Yeah.
Like when it would explode in the
yeah.
concentric
it
rings?
It was like
and, all right.
Oregon Trail,
just
like
checking.
All that stuff. Yeah, yeah. So my first exposure was actually like a Mac SE. Then she moved up at SE2 and she got a laser cutter.
What?
Or like, no, sorry, like a laser printer.
Oh, okay.
I jumped the gun. And at the time, I think they were like $6,000.
Oh, yeah.
But then I started playing with that and I just got, and my parents were really cool for people that are afraid of technology. Like they would let me break their computers and they didn't freak out. So that was really like what I think got me started. And I just, from then on, was like completely hooked to the computer. And then when the internet, like 96, 97, I discovered like Lycos and all this like AltaVista, and then the rest is history.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So were you always like when you're messing around in KidPix and then you got the laser printer, you're always like printing it out?
Yeah.
You like, weren't, it was about like making a hard copy.
Yeah, definitely. But I think actually at some point I became selective. My mom still has the computer because she's kind of a hoarder.
Yeah.
Holla. And and there's still some on there, so I want to do a project with it at some point when she'll like release it to me and I can play with the KidPix again because it still works. So.
Nice. Yeah, I downloaded KidPix recently, actually, but it's like a newer version that can run on like the newer versions of OS X. It lacks some of the classic effects, but I would recommend.
And like just full circle on KidPix, I went to the University of Oregon for undergrad because I was in Portland, and Craig Hickman, who developed KidPix, was my professor.
Oh, get out! That's awesome.
It was amazing. So that really like solidified for me the whole.
Did you sign up? Like, did you take his class? Because it was like Craig Hickman, creator of KidPix.
I didn't
realize. Like,
yeah, it was like in the class, and then it just felt like my entire life was, you know, it was nice. So.
That's awesome. So you're about to teach a workshop right now?
I am. I'm teaching like a Wi-Fi router hacking shop over here, and we've got some lovely contestants lining up.
Yeah, actually, why don't you describe your piece in the show, because I think it's one that maybe does well with a little explaining.
Yeah, I know. I agree. So it's a Wi-Fi tagger. The idea was really stemming from, like, I think the Occupy Wall Street movement and like this whole idea of hacking being a niche, but the evolution of hacking is interesting because we're getting to the point now where it can't be ignored. So like Occupy and Anonymous and these things are kind of bleeding into the mainstream, and I think it's becoming something where, you know, hacking isn't just limited to technology, but it's also about social hacking and community hacking. So bringing hacking into things and getting people to question, which is really like the essence of hacking to me, is like, how do you question hardware? How do you question like things out of the box and kind of like playing with that? It's this like playful curiosity. So it's a way of thinking, really.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a really good way to sum it up. Let's wrap up this episode of Public Access. Thanks, Addy. Thank you, Aram and Evan,
thanks,
for participating.
Guys.
Perhaps we'll do some more of these as we have time. We'll be back at 9 p.m. for Ricky Laska's performance, The Long Cable. So
don't miss it.
Don't miss out. It's going to be
fat.
Good times. It's going to be fat. All right. Thanks, Addy. Thanks, everybody.